Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. It's been a week for political theater, historic handshakes in Annapolis, tense maneuverings in Pakistan, and a whole lot of rumbling in the U.S. presidential campaign. President Bush held a peace conference with Israeli and Palestinian leaders after 7 years of bloody stalemate.
One thing I've assured both gentlemen is that the United States will be actively engaged in the process, that we will use our power to help you.
Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf took off his military uniform, declared he would end emergency rule, and looked ahead to quieter days.
When I came on the scene in 99, we have never had a dull moment, actually. But in these last few months, we have had an excessive degree of turbulence.
And the GOP candidates duked it out in a CNN YouTube debate. No snowman this time, but Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney brought plenty of heat.
You're going to take it's holier-than-thou attitude that you were perfect on immigration.
I'm not perfect.
It just so happened you have a special immigration problem that nobody else here has. You were employing illegal immigrants.
You know,
That is a pretty serious thing. They were under your nose.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes inside these headlines and more. Joining us today from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, globetrotting foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, great to have you back. Thanks.
Nice to be here.
Joining me also from Washington is Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, great to have you back as well. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. As always, Jack, thanks.
Hello, Jane, Rudy. Judy.
Oh, bless you.
Hi, Jack.
I actually called you Rudy.
Well, we can try that for a while.
Forgive me.
Too many debates, Jack.
Yeah, you've got that right, Clarence, and hello to you.
Hi there.
So let's go around the table for thoughts about the big story of the week. Clarence, we'll start with you. What's your headline?
Well, Annapolis, the Mideast talks resuming, if you will, after, a seven-year hiatus, I guess we could say. President Clinton, in the last 6 months of his presidency, made a big push for peace. President Bush now, with his final year approaching, makes his big push for peace as well. And everybody's hoping for the best.
Mm. Trudy, what about you? Your headline.
I think I would agree, and, you know, I guess my headline would be, okay, after the photo op, what next? Mm-hmm. I find the whole thing very worrying because there doesn't seem to be too much preparation for what comes after, and a lot of things that seem to be on the plate now have been tried before and haven't worked. So that's my headline. Where are we going? Because having started this, things will get worse if it goes nowhere.
Jack, do you agree Annapolis the big story of the week?
Yes, it could be, and it could be a bigger story even of the year. But the New York Times, in an analysis yesterday, I think really caught it pretty well, that Secretary Rice really has to push Mr. Bush a lot to get him to say the things that he's going to have to say in order to expedite a settlement there. He said nothing about having Jerusalem as the capital of two states, which is one of the Palestinians' demands. He said nothing about the compensation and resettlement issue for the Palestinians, and he didn't say anything about the settlements on the West Bank. All of these are the issues that are going to be contentious, and remains to be seen whether he will step up to them, or whether even if he does, he has the political capital to be effectual.
Well, let's hear from some of the players from Annapolis this week. First, speaking on Tuesday, President Bush, he read a statement agreed to by the Palestinians and the Israelis just minutes beforehand that set out a timetable for negotiations toward a final treaty.
In furtherance of the goal of two states, Israel and Palestine, living side by side in peace and security, we agree to immediately launch good faith bilateral negotiations in order to conclude a peace treaty, resolving all outstanding issues, including all core issues, without exception, as specified in previous agreements. We agree to engage in vigorous, ongoing, and continuous negotiations and shall make every effort to conclude an agreement before the end of 2008.
Also on Tuesday, President Bush dismissed criticisms that this is the wrong time to negotiate. He said that there were two reasons that make this the right moment to begin.
With leaders of courage and conviction on both sides, now is the time to come together and seek the peace that both sides desire. Second, the time is right because a battle is underway for the future of the Middle East, and we must not cede victory to the extremists.
What do you think, Clarence Page? Is the time right? Are conditions right in the Middle East for peace?
Well, the time is serious. That's certainly true. I was in a press briefing with Prime Minister Olmert after the Annapolis meeting, and he was putting a good face on it, pointing out how we don't have Yasser Arafat around now like in 2000. He was a big impediment getting some kind of a deal, and also the presence of the other Arab states there, Saudi Arabia and others, sort of Syria's presence at the last minute was a hopeful sign. And it's partly a result of, well, they can give some moral support to Abbas and his legitimacy as a Palestinian leader. And also it's a reflection of Iran's role as a rising threat to stability in the region. So there are some elements here that are positive, but this is really Secretary Rice's push, and she's got to push Bush to be engaged in this, just like she tries to push the two parties to get together.
Trudy Rubin, do you think he can be engaged?
You know, it's not just a question of his engagement, although that is absolutely central. It's a question of whether the two parties are so far apart that nobody could push them together at this point. If you notice the speeches of the two men, Olmert and Abbas, Olmert was very general, never mentioned these core issues, which we're talking about, that our final status, refugees, borders, Jerusalem, whereas Abbas needs to be very specific. Otherwise, his people will not support him in doing what Israel wants, which is cracking down on violent terrorists or rebels. And so the two sides need something very different. Olmert wants to get Arab nations to recognize Israel. He wants a process. Abbas wants specifics. And both are supposed to go back to phase one of a peace plan that had failed, simultaneously do this phase one of the so-called roadmap, which means the Palestinians curb violence and the Israelis freeze all settlement construction. Olmert is not talking about that. It's a politically explosive issue in his country. That's where Bush will have to push, and there's no sign yet that that push will come.
Let's hear, as you mentioned, from the Israeli Prime Minister speaking directly to the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas.
I came here despite the concerns and the doubts and the hesitations to say to you, President Mahmoud Abbas, and through you to your people and to the entire Arab world, the time has come. We no longer, and you no longer, have the privilege of adhering to dreams which are dissevered from the sufferings of our peoples.
Jack Beatty, we've been down this path before. Anything different this time?
Well, one thing may be different. The president seems to have grasped, as he didn't several years ago when he famously said he wanted to park this issue, park it. He seems to have grasped that our standing in the Muslim world really depends a lot on getting the right kind of settlement here, that this just isn't something that's an extra or something we just do for our ally Israel to get them better security, although that's important. It's something that's vital to our whole long-term strategy in the Middle East, and he seems to, at least by having this, agreeing to this conference, to have grasped that big strategic point. Whether anything he can exploit it, whether he can stand up to these big issues, it remains to be seen.
All right, from Annapolis to Florida and the GOP presidential debate, Republicans engaged in a lively exchange this week, shall we say, during the CNN YouTube debate. What stood out in your mind after the dust settled, Clarence?
Well, several things. Of course, the interesting confrontation between Rudolph Giuliani and Mitt Romney, being the two front runners over the immigration issue, and who is more soft on illegal immigrants than whom? And Rudolph Giuliani pressing the good old prosecutor, pressing Mitt Romney on some illegal immigrants who were working for apparently a yard work firm that he had hired, and Mitt Romney fighting back. It was a really good exchange, I thought. I don't know how much it signifies, except you know, they're both trying to get on the anti-illegal side of that issue in their party. And also Mike Huckabee, when asked about what would Jesus do in regard to being a presidential candidate, Huckabee said that Jesus had the good sense not to enter politics. I know I'm messing up his punchline there. It was much funnier when he did it. But that's the sort of thing that I think stands out. You know, it's hard to say who wins this debate. I think Mitt Romney probably did because he's the tallest, and tall people tend to come out of these debates the best, I think.
I've got about 15 seconds before the break. Trudy Rubin, who stood out? Clear winner in your mind?
What stood out to me was the nastiness, and that if the primaries don't pick the candidate, God knows we have to go through so much more of this before a candidate is picked. And no one of them thought that he had it in the bag. That's what stood out to me.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. I'm in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. Joining me today from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also joining me from Washington, Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Back to the GOP debate and immigration, which caused fireworks right out of the gate that night. In the debate, Mitt Romney said he welcomed legal immigrants, but Rudy Giuliani's policies went way beyond that as mayor of New York City. Giuliani fired back, and here's Romney first with host Anderson Cooper in the middle.
But the mayor said, and I quote almost verbatim, which is, if you happen to be in this country in an undocumented status, and that means you're here illegally, then we welcome you here. We want you here. We'll protect you here. That's the wrong attitude. Instead, we should say, if you're here illegally, you should not be here. We're not going to give you benefits other than those required by the law, like health care and education. And that's the course we're going to have to pursue.
Mayor Giuliani?
It's unfortunate, but Mitt generally criticizes people in a situation in which he's had far the worst record. For example, in his case, there were six sanctuary cities. He did nothing about them. There was even a sanctuary mansion. At his own home, illegal immigrants were being employed. Not being turned in to anybody or by anyone. And then when he deputized the police, he did it 2 weeks before he was going to leave office. And they never seemed to even catch the illegal immigrants who were working at his mansion. So I would say he had sanctuary mansion, not just sanctuary city.
All right. I got to allow Governor Romney.
Jack Beatty, I'll let you weigh in on the GOP debate this week.
Well, you know, the background to it, immigration, and according to a study that came out just the other day, 10 million new immigrants have come to the country just in the last 7 years, and more than half without legal status. So that's over 5 million undocumented workers just in the last 7 years. So clearly there is a surge of immigration. It's the highest now relative to the population since the 1920s. And what to do about this really, I think, has now become the central issue, or at least the central energizer in the Republican campaign. And what's worrying, other than John McCain, who speaks of the humanity of these people, and Mike Huckabee, who said, you know, really, we shouldn't punish, hold school children accountable for their parents having come here illegally, and indeed help them get into college if we can. Despite that, it's really taken on a very, very negative and almost know-nothing air among Republicans, and to say that Giuliani knows better or that Romney knows, of course they know better. But now, as Tom Tancredo says, they're trying to out-Tancredo Tancredo. And Giuliani, I think, really summed this up very well. In 1996, he diagnosed, it seems to me, what's going on. He said, "The anti-immigration issue that's now sweeping the country, in my view, is no different than the movements that swept the country in the past. You look back at the Chinese Exclusion Act or the Know-Nothing Movement. These were movements that encouraged Americans to fear foreigners, to fear something that is different, and to stop immigration." As E.J. Dionne said, that really fits the mood today among some of these Republicans.
And Trudy Rubin, staying with the Republicans for the moment, in this story this week about Rudy Giuliani and the fact that he apparently billed obscure city agencies for tens of thousands of dollars in security expenses amassed during the time that he was traveling to the Hamptons on the weekends. What do you make of this story? It's got a lot of play this week.
Well, obviously, it's a sexy story, literally, because the issue was whether he was billing them so that he could visit his then-girlfriend, Judith Nathan, while he was still married to the lady who was in the mayor's mansion. I think what struck me, though, is if you're going to talk about Rudy Giuliani, there was, to me, an elephant, a Republican elephant, in the room that nobody talked about because they didn't want to. Giuliani has advisors who want to bomb Iran. And foreign policy was not in this debate because they don't want to argue with each other over it. But this is a guy whose foreign policy advisors and positions, I think, are not well known yet to the American public. And if they were, I wonder whether he would be the front runner, even among Republicans, because he talks about getting the United States into another war. And that was something you never heard. He is, one of his top advisors is Norman Podoretz, whose article that is circulating widely and video clip on the web is Why We Should Bomb Iran. This is a very divisive man. This is a man who also sent Bernie Kerik to Baghdad. I was there when Kerik was there. And Kerik is an astonishing person. He stood up and talked about bringing beet crop roots to Iraq, had no idea where he was. So I think that's another issue that will haunt Giuliani that wasn't aired too much at this debate, which is his judgment on sticking with somebody like Kerik.
But Bernie Kerik has come out and defended him on this, on using these trips to Southampton.
Well, how like him?
All right,
he had a little similar problem.
It's kind of like getting vacation advice from O.J. Simpson, isn't it?
All right, Clarence Page, your turn to the Democrats now. Barack Obama seems to be gaining on Hillary Clinton in Iowa, and you've written a piece about Oprah joining him on the campaign trail. What's your take?
Well, first of all, on his gaining, I had to take great statistical pains to point out that the gain is inside the margin of error. But it shows how in a race that has been so static for so long, I mean, Hillary Clinton's been out there, 20 points or more ahead of Obama for so long, and Edwards trailing about 10 points behind Obama, that the fact that he moved from the back of the margin of error toward the front of the margin of error, he's 3 points ahead in the Washington Post ABC poll, became a big headline. Obama's surge, it certainly ignited some the morale inside of his campaign and among his supporters. And Hillary Clinton, I think, revealed a lot when she started taking snipes at Obama, not mentioning his name, but you know who I'm talking about, kind of thing. I mean, that's kind of like Hertz criticizing Avis. Front runners normally do not make references to their opponents except in a very vague sense. So it adds some excitement as we get close to actual votes or actual caucus meetings being held in Iowa, where the three are in a dead heat.
Well, speaking of Hillary Clinton, in a speech on Tuesday in Iowa, while stumping for her, President Bill Clinton said the following about his position on Iraq. He was immediately attacked for misrepresenting himself.
"Even though I approved of Afghanistan and opposed Iraq from the beginning, I still resent that I was not asked or given the opportunity to support those soldiers."
That comment has triggered outbursts from across the political spectrum. Trudy Rubin, what do you think?
You know, Bill Clinton isn't running for president. Hillary is. There's a legitimate issue about Hillary's positions on Iraq, which Obama is trying to make some hay out of, claiming that right with it. He never supported the war, and she voted for it. There are so many immense issues on Iraq coming down the pike that I find it all a little bit annoying what Bill did or didn't do. I mean, for example, just this week, the United States and Iraqi leaders agreed to a deal whereby by July of next year, there will be an agreement signed between the two governments that will regulate troop use. What this means is there'll be a status of forces agreement that commits U.S. troops for some number of years. We don't know how many. And a new president will come in and find that. So there's real issues going on this week. You know, is Iraq better or worse? What will Democrats have to do? You know, I don't care what Bill Clinton said. Mm.
Jack Beatty, you had some thoughts related to the Democrats this week.
Well, yes. There's a lot at stake in Iowa because of its effect on New Hampshire. I mean, Hillary Clinton has a lead here of 10 to 14 percentage points. And according to experts, there is a 10% bounce coming out of Iowa, usually. So that, but there's also a 10% dip for the loser. So if Obama were to do well in Iowa, historically that says he would close the distance with Clinton here. But Clinton's strength in this state seems to be among women with less than a college education. That is to say, among women who struggle simply to earn a living, given the realities of our economy. Mm-hmm. And I have watched Hillary campaign here, and I have gone to two Obama events. And, you know, Hillary talked at Dartmouth about stem cells. She really led a colloquium about it. And she was, I think, quite brilliant. I mean, no notes, no prepared text, knew the entire issue. Doctors from the audience were saying, my God, you explain this like somebody who's been studying it all your life. But what struck me was how she brought out the dilemmas of people who badly need a miracle from stem cells. There was a young woman there who'd run into a moose on her car. I mean, it's a New Hampshire accident. It's frequent up here. And she's in a wheelchair. And Hillary Clinton just brought out this woman's struggle in a very compassionate and human way. And when a nurse asked a question from the audience, Hillary said, well, tell us a little bit about what you do, about your job, about what goes on. Well, she was really quite I found it quite extraordinary. I mean, and you saw that somehow that message was getting through to women, that this is a person with some compassion and some heart and who looks after people and understands the importance of that. By contrast, Barack Obama, who is tremendously impressive in person. I mean, he just glistens and gleams. He's so stylish and eloquent and elegant. But you don't feel the thing from the heart. You know, recently he had Larry Tribe, his law professor, come up here and say how brilliant he was as a law student. Well, I'm sorry, that doesn't connote anything to people except that he's smart. And he did at one point start to mention that his mother had to once take food stamps in order to get by.
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of story we never hear about him.
Yeah. Listen, Jack, I'm going to turn to the phones now because we've got a caller who's got a question for the panel. In Woburn, Massachusetts, is Dean. Welcome to the program, Dean. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to start by saying, you know, it's a great program, and I wish the best for Tom. But I do want to bring up that my news story this week that struck me surprising was the Zogby poll that put Hillary Clinton losing to any one of the top-tier Republican candidates, and I thought it would be interesting to hear the panel's take on it, which I'll listen to off-air.
Okay.
Especially, if I could just say, I mean, you know, well, actually, no, let me just take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Dean, thanks so much. Any of the Republicans can beat Clinton. What do you think, Clarence Page?
Well, I understand that was an internet poll, which is not the normal scientific way you take polls, and that a similar major poll at the time showed Hillary Clinton still ahead of the Republican field. I don't know if Jack or Trudy know anything more about that.
Trudy?
No, I don't.
Okay.
That's what I'd heard as well, that it was an online poll, that and that simply isn't, for all sorts of obvious reasons, anything like as representative.
However, Drudge Report headlined it, so that means a lot of people are talking about it.
Right.
Back to the phones for a moment to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Bruce, who's on the line now. Welcome, Bruce, to you. Hi.
Hi. What I wanted to comment about earlier, you were talking about who the winner or loser of the debate might have been, and I just wanted to suggest that CNN, to my mind, was the clear loser, given that, well, immediately during the debate, one of the people who was asking the question was identified very quickly as a person who worked on the Clinton campaign, and then later, very soon afterwards, several other of the questioners were identified as people who were working for or identified as people who were supporting other Democratic candidates, and none of these people were identified as such and could have very easily been identified as such with even very superficial investigation on the part of CNN. And to me, it just put brought to light and brought into the open the obvious biases at work.
Bruce, thank you so much. I'll turn this to Clarence.
Do you believe
Page.
In accidents? Do you believe in accidents as opposed to bias? Because that's what the CNN folks are saying. They weren't expecting that. If they had known that I only heard of one person who was interviewed. I saw it on CNN's website last night. A retired general who was gay and a member, a signatory member, but not a contributor to Hillary Clinton's gay, lesbian, bisexual task force committee, whatever it's called. And then he submitted a question, and CNN said, no, had they known beforehand, they would have that he probably would not have been able to participate in the Republican debate. But I don't see any evidence of bias here on their part.
Trudy?
I think these questions would have come up anyway, and probably anyone who asked a question about gay rights would not have been voting for Republican candidates, whether or not their name was on a list. So I don't think that it necessarily skewed the debate, although it doesn't look good.
Last couple of minutes before we go to break, I want to turn internationally to Pakistan. Pervez Musharraf's taken off his uniform, his military uniform. He says he wants emergency rule to end on December 16th. What's the state of Pakistan moving forward, Clarence Page?
Well, the state of Pakistan is in crisis. I mean, as simple as that, a constant crisis. And it is the most dangerous country on the planet, as Newsweek headlined recently. Musharraf has taken off his uniform, which more than I expected. And however, as far as I can tell, he's passing the military authority on to hand-picked successors. In general, the situation is precarious. I'll let Trudy speak. She's more of a foreign policy expert than me.
Okay, Trudy Rubin, go ahead.
The question is whether these elections that are going to take place in January will be legitimate, free and fair. Musharraf still has Supreme Court justices in jail. He still has TV stations under wraps. The justices were about to rule that his second term as president was illegitimate, and so the fact that they're still in jail colors the whole situation. Two of the leaders of big civilian parties are back in the country, Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. Sharif has said he'll boycott because the elections are illegitimate. Benazir is on the fence. Musharraf is trying to split the opposition. Observers will probably not be in there. So it's still a mess. It's still unclear whether Musharraf can survive in civvies. And what's most unclear, which is of critical interest to us, of course, is whether whatever new government comes to power will be willing or able to crack down on Islamist militants in the border, from al-Qaeda to domestic ones that threaten Pakistan.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. It's been a week of old memories passing on. Sports tragedy for the nation's capital and Broadway back on stage. Congressman Henry Hyde, a leader in the Clinton impeachment effort, is dead at 83.
Wherefore, William Jefferson Clinton, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial, and removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
Washington Redskins player Sean Taylor was shot and killed in his home. He was 24. Here's his high school coach at the memorial.
Sean, you were taken from us and your family way too soon. It doesn't seem real that you're gone. It's difficult to comprehend. But you were truly one in a million.
And the Broadway strike ended just in time for the holidays in New York. The shows, including Spamalot, they go on.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the
Joining me today from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Joining me also from Washington is Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. I want to get comments from the panel on the war funding bill. At the Pentagon yesterday, President Bush criticized the Democratic Congress for not immediately approving a new war spending bill. And after more failed attempts to pass legislation ordering troops home from Iraq, some Democrats have said that they plan to sit on President Bush's $196 billion request for war spending until next year.
The American people expect us to work together to support our troops. That's what they want. They do not want the government to create needless uncertainty for those defending our country and uncertainty for their families.
Clarence Page, what about this back and forth?
Well, the war is the biggest issue in the presidential campaign that's unfolding, the presidential race. It is the kind of issue that the issue that shaped this current Congress. The Democratic leadership is under tremendous pressure from constituents not to agree to supporting Bush's war authority any more than they have. At the same time, they're under a great deal of pressure not to appear to be war wimps. What's happened is a bit of Capitol Hill stonewalling, and so this gives each side an opportunity to beat up the other. But I attribute this current stall to election year politics.
Mm. Do you agree, Trudy Rubin?
You know, I think the Democrats have a very serious problem with the war issue because we are in a lull right now. The big question is whether the truly improved security on the ground in Iraq, in Baghdad, and some other places in the country will last, and we don't know. And what we do know is there's big question marks in the future. This whole surge was premised on Iraqi political factions getting together. They haven't done so. But on the other hand, there are truly different scenes on the ground. Now, next spring, these surge troops have to be withdrawn, not because of the Democrats, but because the Army can't sustain the surge. They will probably be gone by July, and then we're going to see whether this has produced just a temporary lull or a permanent move towards some kind of stability. Pushing on funding legislation now looks surly because there is some improvement, and it's as if the Democrats are saying, okay, we don't want to see the improvement, and they can be hit on that in the final campaign. On the other hand, they're being pressured from below. But I think that right now it's a no-win issue in the broader sense, but with their own constituents, obviously they've got a big problem. Mm.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? The success of the surge, is it a double-edged sword for the Democrats at this point?
Yes, but you know, when you start to look at things, especially our military strategy there, you wonder whether we're not sowing seeds for even more long-term harm. We have turned substantially to the air, to bombing. According to Iraq body count, there are now at least 84,000 known dead civilians. And, of course, in American terms, our population, that would be near around a million Americans killed. But they point out that in just this year, the amount of airstrikes that have killed 50,000 people or more has gone up by a factor of 10 from what it was just last year. And that's borne out by other figures. that show that just in the first 9 months of this year, Air Force planes have dropped more munitions on Iraq than in the previous 3 years combined. So in order to protect our forces in the surge, we're now out of their bases and in the neighborhoods or in other areas, we're bombing. And everybody, in fact, General Petraeus, in his field manual, he warned about this. He said an airstrike can cause collateral damage that turns people against the host nation government and provides insurgents with a major propaganda victory. And yet that's our strategy there. We're relying heavily on bombing. And in Afghanistan, Allied bombing has killed more people than the Taliban thus far this year. And so I think this is sort of under the radar, but the strategy we're following is by no means benign, and it's been very costly to civilians.
So, panel, I want to turn to the economy for a moment and to home sales. New home sales managed a small gain last month, as is reported today, but prices have tumbled, and new home sales year-to-date are down about 24%. On a related note this morning, in a speech last night, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke hinted at another cut in interest rates to bolster the economy. We keep hearing the dreaded R word, Clarence Page, recession. What's your take?
Well, it's hard to. I'm reminded of the old story about how economists have predicted 14 out of the last five recessions. I don't want to jump to that yet, but the housing bubble is deflating, as was expected. You know, if you just have the people who were buying income properties, you know, second or third homes, as investments, if you get them to stop buying their investments for a while, you suddenly lose 10 or 20% of the market. I forget the exact figure, but it's a big chunk of the explosion in home sales over the decade is in income property. So that to me is bubble right there, and we're seeing that especially in the outer suburbs where you've had the most recent home construction. So a lot of this is mathematical, which is can be devastating for a lot of people who live in those areas, and this is their first and only home, say, and suddenly the value has gone down, and maybe they had a balloon mortgage, and one of the mortgages that has interest rates that have suddenly surged up or are about to, and I think they're the ones who really have the biggest problem right now that needs to be taken care of.
To our foreign affairs columnist Trudy Rubin, a question for you. A headline in the New York Times today warns of chaos in Russia. Gary Kasparov, the former chess champion, was just released from jail after spending about 5 days in a sentence there for leading an opposition march. He warns that Russia is heading toward chaos under Vladimir Putin. What's going on over there?
Well, I sympathize with Garry Kasparov, who is trying to mobilize a Russian opposition in a country that seems happy to have a return of authoritarian rule after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was chaos and there was monetary collapse, and I was there many times then. People were in a terrible state, and so sadly, instead of looking to democracy, democracy has gotten a bad name. They seem to want dictatorship, and Putin is obliging as a former KGB man. I think that what we're looking at in coming elections this weekend for parliament and presidential elections in the spring is simply return of authoritarian rule, the opposite of chaos, but authoritarian rule based on oil money. It's sort of like Venezuela, like Iran. Putin can float along because he can buy off the public who just want peace and quiet. And sadly, for opposition folks like Garry Kasparov, who recognize that that's no basis for a real country, they're either going to jail or going to be silenced.
Back to politics in this country now. Trent Lott is stepping down after his resignation announcement this week. It was widely speculated that the Mississippi Republican was quitting to avoid new ethics rules that require senators to wait 2 years instead of one before becoming highly paid Capitol Hill lobbyists. Clarence Page, what's your take on this story?
Well, I wish Trent Lott the best of luck in his new career. I think, what stands out to me is that it's a vote of no confidence in the Republicans' ability to regain the Senate next year. And he's getting out while he can, while also before the new ethics rules take hold that make it more difficult for him or members of his staff to go out and profit from the expertise they've gained there in the Senate.
Here he is on Monday, Trent Lott in Mississippi, saying he's going to retire from the Senate by the end of the year.
I don't have any problem. This is not a negative thing. There's no malice, no anger. There's nothing but happiness and pride at the job that I've been allowed to do by the people of Mississippi and by my colleagues in the House and Senate. I don't know what the future holds for us. A lot of options hopefully will be available. I've always thought I might like to teach some. Son of a school teacher, why wouldn't I want to do that? Our son Chet is turning out to be a pretty good musician. Maybe I could manage his musical career.
Jack Beatty on a go ahead, Trudy.
I was going to say, I think he does know what the future holds since he's getting out now so that he can become a lobbyist sooner rather than, what is it, the new rules will require you to wait two years. So I guess he knows pretty well.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, so many Republicans leaving Congress.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're 15 or 16 in the House, and is it 6 now in the Senate? I don't really have the exact figures, but and they're leaving for a reason. I mean, I just saw figures the other day. In the House, the Democrats are outraising the Republicans nearly 3-1 for campaign funds. Now, that may be a good news for the Democratic Party. Question is whether it's good news for America with all that money. All that money will come with a price attached. You know, I think Trent Lott is going to be remembered as much for his comment about Strom Thurmond at that ill-fated birthday party as for anything else in his public career. Because, you know, he was really speaking out of a kind of old-time Southern white bigotry that, you know, the problems in the country would have been taken care of. Well, that would have meant, of course, that the color line would have stayed what it was back in 1948. And Senator Lott mentioned his mother, a teacher. She was a teacher, but she was also a member of the White Citizens Council down there. And she wrote very scalding letters to the local press about, against any kind of integration. So goodbye to Mr. Lott and good riddance.
To the phones, to Waverly, Iowa, and Linda, who's joining the conversation. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Just to go back to foreign policy for a bit.
Okay.
My general question is, why is it that we can dictate to the rest of the world what they can do? Now, I don't think that Iran should probably have a nuclear weapon, but we have a nuclear weapon. When India and Pakistan got them, they really didn't suffer any serious penalties, and in the case of Pakistan, it brings this to mind most plainly, we don't want him to be the head of his military because he can be a dictator, but yet our president is the head of our military.
Mm. I'm running out of time, and I'm going to ask for your question for Trudy Rubin.
Sure. On the Pakistan issue, I don't think it's because we want him not to be a dictator. I think you've seen quite extraordinary demonstrations in Pakistan by judges, by lawyers, by middle-class people. There is a real distaste in Pakistan for him as a military ruler, and I think that's one main reason why he took off the uniform but is still trying to keep his powers. As far as Iran goes, if Iran didn't have a president that was calling for Israel to be wiped off the map and taking, you know, very aggressive positions in other countries like Lebanon, I don't think that you would have so much worry, but you would still have an issue because Iran is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has violated it in spirit and fact by not coming clean about secret programs that it had which were in violation of its signature. So there are issues here in terms of international regulations and in terms of the policies of the Iranian leaders that make it legitimate to question Iran's program, which most experts believe is trying to get a bomb, not peaceful.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to round out the hour by letting Clarence Page weigh on a very interesting story this week in the New York Post about a guy who won the lottery, won $1 million in the Massachusetts lottery. Clarence, the problem was he was on parole.
Yes, this reminded me of a recent study that came out showed that a large percentage, something like a fourth of our state prison inmates are there for technical parole violations, meaning they didn't go out and, you know, rob a bank or kill anybody. They didn't appear at their parole officer's office for some reason or another, or some other technical violation, like buying a lottery ticket, which you can't do apparently in Massachusetts and a lot of other places if you're on parole, even though it's a state lottery.
And I guess there's a court hearing to determine if he's going to back to jail.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's the larger serious issue here that makes this a tragic comedy, just a tad even more tragic. Besides losing all that money.
Right, $1 million.
Right.
Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. So great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And from Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, great to have you.
Thanks, Jane.
And Jack Beatty from Hanover, New Hampshire, as always, our senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine and On Point news analyst. Jack, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.